Well, I'm a guy that wrote the Shrimp and Weenies memo.
Are you serious?
And only, and I noticed that Microsoft now has about 60,000 people. And when I, our employees, we assume they're people. And when I left in 99, there were only about 30,000.
Are you really the guy who wrote that
memo? I wrote Shrimp and Weenies.
Because yes. Gates signed that, right? Or sent
it? No, it went out under my name.
It went out under your name?
Yes. Yeah. And the idea there was that the company, and it probably got written in the early 90s.
So what's your name, by the way?
I'm Mike Murray.
Mike Murray.
Right,
okay.
I came to Microsoft in 89 and left Microsoft in 99. So I had a really fun 10-year run in the company. And early in the 90s, we thought the company was acting a little rich at times. We'd go into catered lunches, and instead of, you know, the equivalent of weenies, there'd be shrimp all over the place, and we thought, how in the world can this company afford this?
Yeah.
So we...
how could they?
we don't know. So I drafted this email called Shrimp and Weenies, and Bill looked at it, and he said, yeah, you can send that out. So we sent it out, and it became one of these legendary things that I think even today...
Oh, I got it when I joined Microsoft. Yeah, somebody said it here.
It's used for indoctrination.
They sent me the famous memos, you know?
Right. So, and now, so I actually ended up being monetarily successful at Microsoft, something grew up in a small town in Oregon, and I never expected the type of financial success that I gained during that period of time, so...
So we're not at Microsoft right now.
We are not at Microsoft.
Most of my viewers are.
That's right.
We're on interview Microsoft guys.
Well, we're not only on a field trip for this video blog, but we are completely outside of the bits and bytes world.
Yeah.
So
what are you doing now?
Well, the bits that I work in now are little dollar bills, and I'm in the poverty world. As I got outside of Microsoft, I started expanding my ideas about what's going on in the world, and you know, this is $2 right here.
Yeah.
$2. 4 billion people in the world live on $2 a day or less.
And that's so hard for me to even understand.
Right.
Know?
And particularly in the world that we are so blessed to live in,
yeah.
In the technology world, this is a latte, and it's no big deal.
It's not even a latte.
It's not even a latte.
A latte is $3.
Yeah. So you know, you can't even afford a latte anymore, and yet.
Yeah.
Two-thirds of the world has to live on this much per day. I got introduced to an idea while I was still at Microsoft called microcredit lending, and that's the practice of lending small amounts of money, $50, $100, $150, to a very, very poor person in India, Africa, someplace in the world, and they use this money to literally transform their lives. This is not a handout. It's a financial transaction. It's a loan, and they have to repay it. I started learning about this, I traveled around the world, went to different places, and then a group of us realized that there was a crack or a seam in the 30-year-old microfinance industry that was preventing the industry from growing and becoming what it could be. It'd be as if Microsoft had gotten stuck small,
yeah.
And had 1,000 employees and was selling MS-DOS to their friends in the Puget Sound, and they just thought that was a good idea.
Yeah.
So we took ideas from our experiences in the high-tech industry, or some of people are bankers, and we said, how can we create an explosive, highly accelerated marketplace to allow microcredit lending to become a household name throughout the world, particularly for the $2 a day people?
Yeah.
So we created an organization called Unitas. It's one word, but it's two things pushed together. Unite and us pushed together, one word. So we're here today because this is a shameless plug for Unitas. Yeah. As the giving campaign starts.
Yeah. And Microsoft every year has a giving campaign, right? So Microsoft employees can go to http://give and donate money and donate time now, right? If I donated time to your charity, your charity actually gets $17 per hour now. That was just announced. So
we'd be glad to take all the time and all the money anyone would like to give us.
Yeah.
The interesting and hard thing here is that only 2% of all philanthropy in the world, all the philanthropy in the U.S. goes outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
Most people, and for all good reasons, like giving to their churches or their schools or their hospitals or educational programs or other issues in their local communities. And I do that too.
Yeah.
But only 2% of all philanthropy ends up in the forsaken places of the world where people are living in such desperate lives.
Yeah.
So we also want to educate people that there's great opportunities and great leverage if you want to give to organizations like UNITAS. Now this coming Monday in the Mount Sai room, I'm going to show up in live, not just on a blog, but my whole person will be there.
Yeah.
And we're going to preview a PBS documentary that we've been involved in making over the last year. That gives it's an hour-long documentary, and it gives the story of how microfinance and microcredit transforms lives throughout the world.
Wow.
And we want to educate people. UNITAS is a fairly new organization, but it's the thing that I throw all my time into. Today, we're working with almost a 500,000 people around the world, and most of them are women. And that's an important message for Microsoft. The microfinance movement is all about women's empowerment. And most of the time, very, very poor women are stuck in their little village houses with not much to do. But with $100, a woman can purchase, for instance, in India, a water buffalo. And that's the same as a dairy cow. And she milks it twice a day and gets 2.5 liters of milk. And there's a ready market for this. It takes her a year to pay off her $100 loan. $2 a week plus interest on the loan. But after a year, she owns this asset that is now an income-producing asset for the next 6-7 years.
Interesting.
And then she can get another loan and another loan, and before you know it, she's a small-time farmer and she is putting better food on the table, she's buying medicine when her kids are sick now, she's improved her housing, and most importantly from my point of view, her kids are going to school.
Yeah.
And when her kids graduate from school in 10 years, there's no way they're going to go back and live the life that their mother, grandmother, great-grandmother lived. So this is a one-generation solution, permanent solution, to world poverty issues.
Wow.
So we are what we do is we take a venture capital approach of finding the very best organizations that are already out there, and then we say to them, how about we help you get 10 times bigger, 20 times bigger, 50 times bigger than you already are. An example in India, 3 years ago, we started with a group that was working with 10,000 women,
yeah.
And now they're working just a short time later with about 150,000 women. They could have never done that without our help as a microfinance accelerator.
Yeah.
So we take these ideas of how do you grow really fast, the things that we're all very comfortable with at a Microsoft or other technology environments, and we're applying that in a nonprofit space that has never seen that before.
Yeah.
So we're taking innovation, business practices, good IT thinking, good management thinking, and we're stepping on the gas pedal because it's just terrible that so many people have to live in such a desperate situation.
Yeah. Wow. Tell me about some of the trips you've taken around the world and what kinds of things you've seen and how it's different from Silicon Valley or from here in Redmond. Or
one of the most important trips I took was a long time ago when you were probably just a kid. It was 19...
I'm 40, so...
I'll test you. It was 1983.
I was graduating from high school.
Okay, great. We're glad you graduated, by the way. Yeah. I mean, I don't think people really even knew that about you. I was working for Apple Computer, getting
wow.
ready to launch the Macintosh. But it was a year before that, and they had an international sales meeting in Acapulco. I'd never been there. I think I'd seen an Elvis movie once where they're jumping off cliffs and diving, and I thought, wow, I'm going to Acapulco, Mexico for a sales meeting. I go down there, and I quickly realize I hate sales meetings. I get fidgety, they're kind of boring to me, and all the rah-rah speeches. So I ducked out and went out to the beach to walk on the beach in the middle of the day. And I'm walking on the beach, and here comes this little 8-year-old boy and his 6-year-old sister. She's blind, and he's pulling her behind him with his arm, and he's coming up to beg. Well, I grew up in a small town in America, and I never had a beggar ever come up to me.
Yeah.
I also had my own children at home who were about the same age at the time.
Yeah.
And that affected me. I have no idea what topics were covered in this Apple sales meeting,
yeah.
But I still remember the feeling I had of this 8-year-old boy and his blind 6-year-old sister, and I probably gave them $5.
Yeah.
But that was a completely unsatisfactory experience for me because I knew I was just putting a Band-Aid on a wound that would never heal.
Yeah.
Fast forward to 1998, I think, and I'm sitting in my office at Microsoft. I'm the VP of HR at the time, and I get this desperate phone call from a lower-level employee in the group that was then called PSS, the Product Support Group.
Yeah.
And she said, I promised this guy that if he came to Microsoft, he could meet with a bunch of executives, and, well, he's here, and no one will meet with him. Would you please help him? Well, I reached in my drawer, I looked at my business card, it said VP of Human Resources, and I always thought that that meant I was the one person in the company paid to be nice. So, the only appropriate answer was, sure, bring him over.
Yeah.
I can meet with anybody for an hour and be nice. And I didn't know who this person even was.
Yeah.
So this woman, who I'd never met before, brings over this guy, and he sits at my table, and he introduces himself, and his name is Mohammed Yunus, from Bangladesh, and he runs the Grameen Bank. I don't know what any of that meant.
Okay.
Well, he starts talking to me, and he's one of the fathers of the microcredit industry.
Yeah.
And he started out by giving some of his own money to very poor women in Bangladesh, not as handouts, but as loans, as a social experiment. He was an economics professor. By this time in 1997, the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, which only gives loans to poor women, had a network of 2.5 million women working in 40,000 villages where they were giving loans. Now, I love free market economics. I like the good parts of capitalism. I love the way both at Apple and Microsoft we were able to create thousands of jobs and hundreds of thousands of little companies that support the industry. No governments involved. No one's telling you what to do. It's just the creativity and drive of good people. Well, this guy was telling me, here's how you can help that boy on the beach.
Yeah.
You don't have to give him money. You actually create a free market capital transaction, a loan, and they pay back the loans. In fact, in these good programs, 98% of the loans are repaid.
Wow.
Better than what a lot of real banks get.
Yeah.
So
there's
credit
card fraud here in the United States.
So I had to learn more about this. So then soon after that, I found a group called Acción International, which is in Washington, D.C., and they work in Latin America. They invited me to go down to Bolivia to see some programs there. So my wife and I went to Bolivia. We'd never taken a trip like this.
Go ahead.
And we went to Bolivia and went out into these remote villages in a very, very high elevation and talked to these peasant women who looked exceptionally poor.
Yeah.
And we were finding out that even though they may look poor, they were very, very smart in terms of running their small stalls in the markets. And they were using the income they were making to educate their children, to buy better food, to provide better clothing, and to create a future for themselves. And as you, and now, using our Western and particularly American bias, if we would have breezed through that village on some kind of a regular tourist trip going from point A to point B, we would have looked out the window with a great bias and said, look at those poor people. You know, if they would just try a little harder, if they would just get up a little earlier, if they would just, you know, use the internet, they'd have a much better life. But obviously they're lazy and they're just not doing it. Well, shame on us.
Yeah.
Because you get in and you start talking to them, you realize, wow, their challenge is that they are zip code challenged.
Yeah.
They were born in the wrong place through no fault of their own.
Yeah.
My blessing is that I was born in the right place and got to have a great education and have had a great life.
Absolutely.
So the idea that...
I grew up a mile from where you was working in Cupertino.
Cupertino?
You know, okay,
so now...
That's really why I'm here, you know.
Of course you are.
I've been around geeks all my life.
and you shouldn't apologize for that.
Yeah.
But we got to now make sure we're doing something good in our lives about it. So now this is $100.
Yeah.
And I'm not paying you for this interview, by the way. That's not part of the shameless plug. This is all it takes to permanently transform a person's life, in the form of a loan, not a handout. We loaned this to this woman in the village. She buys a sewing machine. She buys materials to make a dress. Not just one dress every 3 months, but now she can make 10 dresses and have selection and have a shop and a business starts. She knows how to do that. She's just been capital constrained. Money's always been available in the developing world. But you may have refinanced your mortgage lately from, I don't know, 7% to 4.5%.
Yeah.
What if your mortgage was a 300% mortgage? What size of house would you be living in?
Yeah.
The cost of money for most people, poor people in the developing world right now, is between 300% to 3,000% annually.
Really?
There's loan sharks and money lenders every place. They're very glad, Robert, to give you money.
Yep.
But 300% interest rate, there's no profit left. There's no ability to get ahead.
Yeah.
What if that interest rate got shot down to 20% to 30%? Would you know what to do now? You bet you would.
Mm-hmm.
So a microcredit loan, a $100 loan at a 20 to 30% interest rate, why so high? Because it costs money to run these organizations.
Yeah.
But you now have shrunk the cost of capital dramatically. You can make money and you're off to the races.
Yeah.
So our role at Unite is to accelerate, dramatically accelerate this industry. We've just set up an office in India, in Bangalore.
Yeah.
We were the first international microfinance organization to do that. We're having an open house in a couple of weeks in Bangalore. We have an initiative to reach 10 million families in India in the next 10 years. A shorter metric is 1 million families by the end of 2006.
Yeah.
These are numbers that have never been talked about before in this industry. There's lots of good organizations doing this work, but they usually work kind of at the mom and pop level.
Yeah.
So we're saying, hey, this idea is too good. Let's see if we can't grow it dramatically.
Yeah. For me, there's two kinds of people in the world, right? There's people who are in my situation, which I make less than $100,000 a year. So giving, you know, $100 or $500 or $1,000 is probably the extent of what I'm able to do in a year, or maybe I could stretch a little bit more than that, but that's probably what I'm doing. And for me, I guess for both me and somebody at, you know, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates level, they're able to give a lot more, but they're probably giving, they're probably able to find out where the money can really make the most sense. For me, I'm going to go to, you know, give on the internet, and I'm going to be faced with a bunch of brand names, right?
Yes.
You know, Red Cross, United Way, you know, the usual kinds of places that people think of when they think of charitable giving. How does somebody at my level how do the two people decide, how should we decide where to give our money or give our time?
It's a very appropriate question. The first thing I like is that you've decided that you want to give.
Yeah.
That you're going to take some portion, whether it's 1%, 5%, 10% of your income, and start giving it. That's terrific. And that should be a pattern. That's a pattern I endorse for the rest of your life. Then you got to decide, what am I passionate about? What really, not just intellectually, but also in my heart, seems to strike me that's a good thing?
Yeah.
And whether it's education, healthcare, women's issues, AIDS issues, the environment. There's a long list of generic ways that we can get involved
in
things.
Katrina victims.
Sure.
And there's a lot of organizations and people with their hands out. Right?
Always. Yeah. Always, always, always. And the world always needs a lot of help. And in my case, the way I ended up doing this work was that I think that people need the most help. And if people can become self-reliant and build stronger lives for themselves and their families, then they will build stronger communities. They will build stronger states. They will build stronger nations. The world will actually become more secure. The world will become more successful. They will want to improve the education situation and the healthcare situations in their countries.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I also like the idea of using an economic model rather than a top-down handout, where you, in many cases, are disempowering people rather than empowering people.
Yeah.
So, from my point of view, I'm thinking about education. I'm thinking about environment. I'm thinking about healthcare when I'm doing this kind of work. But that's just been the personal journey I've been through over the last 6-7 years as I found my voice for where I think the greatest good can be done. But someone who wants to give specifically to one of these other areas, I'd say do your homework, which is actually today pretty easy to do. In our case, let's say last year, we looked at over 100 different partners that we might partner with, organizations to partner with to do microfinance work around the world. We approach it a bit like a venture capitalist looking at business deals. We did due diligence on over 100 different organizations, and we picked just 4 to partner with. Well, so if a person's interested in microcredit, knowing that Unitas is so analytical and so precise and so exacting would give somebody a great deal of comfort, as opposed to saying, hey, I heard about this group down in Guatemala. I think I want to send them some money.
Yeah.
How do you really do the due diligence to know if they're the kind of organization you ought to be working with?
The other thing I'm concerned about, it, let's say I give $1,000, I want to make sure that money gets to where, you know, my passions are, right?
Yes.
And where it can actually help people and not end up in your pocket, right?
So the first thing you want to do is check the parking lot. Meaning, metaphorically, is the organization using your donation to overpay their employees, to have a beautiful corporate headquarters, and the money's not going downstream?
Yeah.
In our case, we are so focused at running a very efficient organization, so the majority of the money goes downstream, and we also leverage our money, so we're able to get lines of credit, debt products, etc., with banks, and sometimes we get 10 times. You donate $1,000, that might become $10,000 worth of loan product that can actually be put out into the marketplace.
Yeah.
So we're very clever about how we can do that as well. But again, being skeptical about the way nonprofits work, I think is a very healthy thing to do always.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that I should look at to judge, you know, where my money should go?
You need to talk to people.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing. And also, here's another thought too, in terms, because Microsoft employees can give their time.
And it's not just Microsoft, right? This video is watched around the world.
Sure.
And, you know, all the major companies my friends work at in Silicon Valley have giving campaigns as well.
Yeah. So another thought is, you're never too young, you're never too old, you're never too busy to become either a board member of a good nonprofit or an advisor or even a helper of some kind. And it doesn't mean that you're writing code for them. You've got a brain. You can think you're a natural problem solver. There's lots of good things. Every nonprofit can use one more person helping them in some way. Yeah. And that's a great way, before you even start giving too much of your money away, get involved.
Yeah.
And if they're resistant and don't really want you, well, that tells you something too. So we have helpers, we have a full-time professional staff that we pay, and this is their livelihood, but we also have helpers, we have advisors, we have board members, we have people who do something for us maybe just once a year, because that's all the time they can have. Yeah. That's terrific. And we want to embrace them, and I think that's the kind of spirit you want to feel in any nonprofit organization you're working with. But ultimately, you want to ask yourself, was my money used in a way that I feel really good about, and is it actually helping in a way that's an extension of me and the values that I have?
Okay. Anything else I should know about the world of charitable giving, or...
The world,
or tell us some old stories of Microsoft. Give us the dirt, since you are HR director.
Now that you will have to pay me for. I couldn't be doing what I'm doing today were it not for the time I spent at Microsoft. And we worked exceptionally hard. There were good days and there were bad days, and that's generally what life's like. But I was able to have success in a way that I never warranted. And now I feel a great responsibility to literally give much of that back, so that I do it in a way that promotes permanent improvements and not just names on a plaque someplace that stroke my ego. What else to think about though? As you get out into the world, I encourage people to travel internationally. When you do travel internationally, get out of the 5-star hotel and go into a couple blocks away from those hotels, and you'll start seeing a world that you really never knew, and at first you may be scared.
Yeah.
Because it feels so different.
Yeah, I walked around Shanghai that way, and it was scary, and I almost got lost, and it's very disorienting to be in a new place. But.
And sometimes even hiring a tourist guide who will take you back into the cities is a great way to learn about how people really live, and you're going to find something. You're going to find out they're much more like you than they are not like you.
Yeah.
They're bright, they're inquisitive, they know often about America or about the Western world.
Right.
They want to learn about it, but they also want to succeed and grow in their own countries. Why not give them a chance?
Yeah. Well, thanks for meeting with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah,
it's great.
You.